One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. Lucy Mack Smith was born July 8, 1775 in New Hampshire, the youngest of eight children to Solomon and Lydia Gates Mack. She is best known as the mother of the prophet Joseph Smith. Here to talk about the life of this remarkable Latter-day Saint woman is Sherilyn Howcroft. Sherilyn is employed by the Church History Department and currently works on the Joseph Smith papers. Sherilyn, welcome.
Thank you.
Please tell us a little bit more about yourself, if you would.
I've been working with the Joseph Smith Papers Project since 2000 in a number of varying responsibilities. At this point, I'm doing a number of things with the project. Predominantly, my responsibilities are with the legal series and then working on material that will be posted on the Joseph Smith Papers website at josephsmithpapers.org.
What are some of the other things you've worked on through your career?
Oh, it's wide and varied. As far as Mormon history, I'm a newcomer to Mormon history, relatively speaking. A lot of my schooling has been in English literature and predominantly African-American lit. And then I turned to Mormon history, surprisingly, after I came back from the Middle East, from the BYU Jerusalem Center. I think of myself as a late bloomer when it comes to Mormon history, because it wasn't necessarily my forte growing up. As far as Lucy Mack, I had an early interest in Lucy Mack Smith. My parents had these large bookshelves in our living room growing up. And I remember seeing this one book, being drawn to this particular book, and it was the history of Joseph Smith as related by his mother, Lucy Mack Smith. And I remember opening that up at 11 years old and looking through the pages and reading several passages from it. Of course, not entirely comprehending everything that was in it, but understanding that this was a deeply remarkable record, that there was something truly special about that record. And so that's how, when my love for Lucy Mack began.
What are some of the things you find most interesting about Lucy Mack Smith?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, at this time in American history, the idea of women writing their memoirs was truly unique. In terms of Mormon history, this is the first impetus for Mormon historiography from women. And so there's a great deal of information that we get from her in terms of her life, her family's history, as well as Joseph's life's experiences that we really don't get anywhere else. It's from Lucy that we get a sense of her familial genealogy, information on her father and her mother, her brothers and sisters. Lucy is the one that tells us about Joseph Smith's leg operation. And so that's a story that has become so much a part of the narrative of Joseph's history today that we don't necessarily think of that contribution coming from his mother. There are a number of things that are in her history that are indicative of her faith, of her testimony in the restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There is, given the number of experiences that she had in her life, in her the sufferings, the persecution that she experienced, there is no question that she had an unshakable testimony. She had to have that in order to withstand the experiences that she went through.
Very good. Let's jump back
to early Lucy Mack and talk a little bit about her upbringing and her parents, perhaps, and where she lived and how she became who she was.
Okay. First of all, her ancestors had lived in New England for several generations. Her family members were Seekers. Now, Seekers were people that it wasn't a religious sect per se. It was a religious society, and they believed that all organized religions were corrupt. But they had the sense they believed in religion, but they believed in seeking after truth and believing that if they asked, that God would give to them. Her spiritual leanings were fostered and cultivated through her family. Her father, Solomon Mack, really wasn't a religious man per se. He became religious in his later years after several spiritual experiences that he had in relation to prayer. A lot of her religious instruction that she received growing up came from her mother, Lydia Gates, and also her educational opportunities. Her mother, Lydia, was a school teacher, and her mother insisted on her children continuing faithful in their exercise of the religious duties all throughout their lives. And so given this context of her growing up years, early on she had instilled in her this faith in spirituality.
Was the fact that her mother was more of the spiritual leader in the home a new thing in America or the time, or was this something that had been around a long time?
Well, within the Smith family, I don't think that it was particularly a problem. Her father was, although he wasn't affiliated with religion at the time that she was growing up, there was still that sense of family values, of religious values, so to speak. And Solomon Mack attributed the piousness of his children to his wife and the nature of their home. So she was certainly a guiding force in the growing in the raising of her children. As far as the larger scope of American religious history, I think that there is a tendency to downplay the effect that women had within the time. Granted, although the women seem to be excluded from the record, excluded from the history, there is no question that their fundamental influence was experienced in the home. And so those first initial leanings of religion, of sense of moral duty, sense of patriotic duty, was certainly part of the teachings and doings of the mothers.
From some of the things I've read, there was a push in America toward a more commercial type economy, which probably put the fathers more away from the home, and that's put the mothers more in the position of having to be not only the teachers but the spiritual leaders of the home as well, with the fathers being away. And as you mentioned, the moral part of it, moral being a moral mother, you know, having to be the spiritual leader, and it seems like that had a pretty deep impact on Lucy, because she became the very same type of leader in her home.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was certainly a strictness of spirituality within her home, and that she certainly passed that on to her children, and it's evident in their lives and the way in which they conducted spiritual matters in their own home.
Lucy suffered at one point from what they called confirmed consumption. It was the same disease that claimed two of her sisters. What effect do you think that sickness and her subsequent recovery had on her life?
Oh, it had a fundamental impact on her life. As you said, she had lost her two sisters, Levice and Levina, several years earlier to consumption, otherwise known today as tuberculosis. This experience was pivotal in her life when she was when her health was declining with consumption. She had a Methodist exhorter come to her and said, are you ready to die? Are you ready to meet your maker? And she realized, she writes in her history about how she recognized that she was not ready to die, but also that she, her life was not in such an order that she was ready to meet her God. And so she, at this time, you can imagine how unsettling her sickness would be in her family. At this time, she had two children, Alvin and Hiram, and their ages were roughly around 1 and 3 years old. And Joseph Sr. is fearful that she's going to die. The doctors believe she's going to die. And it's at this time that she has a very intimate prayer to the Lord. And I would like to read from her history that experience.
Please.
Specifically. She says, I then looked to the Lord and begged and pleaded with him to spare my life in order that I might bring up my children and be a comfort to my husband. During the night, I made a solemn covenant with God that if he would let me live, I would endeavor to serve him according to the best of my abilities. Shortly after this, I heard a voice say to me, seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Let your heart be comforted. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. Now, a passage of that is coming from Luke chapter 11, verse 9. But after this sickness, she became, of course, she recovered, and after the sickness, she became absorbed in the subject of religion. And she was unaffiliated with any particular sect at the time. Joseph Smith Sr. Was a universalist. He believed that all people would be saved and would receive salvation. Lucy was firm in her belief of the need for baptism, and she continued to search various religions.
It seems to be a common theme among strong believers, this experience she had where there's a serious crisis in her life. She makes basically a personal covenant with God and then is an unfailing faithfulness throughout their life. I think that's she's an amazing example of that pattern.
She is, and there's so many examples in her life of a deeply personal relationship with God. When she has several moments of crisis in her life where she turns to God and pleads to him for her cause, and he answers her prayer. And then there are times in the latter part of her history where she's discussing the injustices and the persecution that the family has experienced, that she also believes that God will give her justice. And it's a sense of not earthly justice, but the justice that only a heavenly tribunal could provide. And she was confident in that although her sons had been murdered, that God would ultimately be a just judge.
So let's talk about her sons for a few minutes. She had seven sons and how many daughters? Three, was it?
She had three daughters, and then she had a couple of sons that died. But she had Alvin and Hiram, Joseph, Samuel, and William and Don Carlos. She lost Don Carlos in 1841. And then Joseph and Hiram at the martyrdom. And then she lost Samuel a month later. I can't even comprehend the grief that a mother would experience in losing so many sons within a three-year time frame, and how consuming that grief would be to the average person. But she was no average woman.
We've fairly well established, at least early on in her family, that she was the spiritual leader. Once Joseph had the first vision, did it take her some time to come on board with with what that was all about, as far as the family was concerned, or was it immediate?
Well, it's interesting. There's a segment in history where it discusses how Joseph, shortly after receiving the first vision, he comes back to the home, and immediately mother knows something is different. Something's just off. And she asked him what was wrong. And he replied to her, "Never mind, all is well. I am well enough off." And so immediately she knew that something in the countenance of her son was different, and she was alert to that. But there's several things that, in terms of the family support of Joseph's mission of Joseph restoring the gospel of Jesus Christ, there are very interesting snippets coming from Lucy Mack Smith's history that tell us about their sense of the reception that the Smith family had of these experiences that Joseph was having. One that Lucy refers to is his reference to all the stories that are coming from the Book of Mormon. I'd like to read from her history regarding the family hearing these stories. Lucy says, "From this time forth, Joseph continued to receive instructions from the Lord, and we continued to get the children together every evening for the purpose of listening while he gave us a relation of the same. He would describe the ancient inhabitants of this continent, their dress, mode of traveling, and the animals upon which they rode, their cities, their buildings, with every particular, their mode of warfare, and also the religious worship. This he would do with as much ease, seemingly as if he had spent his whole life with them." And she goes on to say, you know, what a curiosity, what a spectacle our family would be if people saw us in terms of how eager we were to hear these stories and to be a part of this, to see everything unfold. And for the most part, the organization of the church, the establishment of the early church, was a very, very intimate experience. The number of people that were involved was really quite small, and so there was a closeness of this group of people that was really quite remarkable.
So, speaking of that involvement, once converted to Joseph's mission in helping restore the gospel of Jesus Christ, Lucy did not look back, so to speak. And what was some of her involvement in the affairs of the restoration?
Well, one of my favorite stories is when she is traveling with some Fayette saints to Kirtland. Now, this is there's a small band of saints that are traveling on boat by the Erie Canal, and this is around May of 1831. And their boat is stuck at Buffalo, and their passage is frozen over with ice. And there begins to be some murmuring among the people on the boat. Now, not all the people on the boat were LDS, of course, but the she rebukes the people for their conduct because they start evidencing a lack of faith and a lack of trust in the purposes of God, that, you know, they will end up in Kirtland. And she gives this remarkable and beautiful monologue of rebuking them for their lack of faith. And she asks them, "Where is your faith? Where is your confidence in God? Can you not realize that all things were made by him and that he rules over the works of his own hands? And suppose that all the saints here should lift their hearts in prayer to God, that the way might be open before us, how easily it would be for him to cause the ice to break away, so that in a moment we could be on our journey." Now she asks the people that are there, she says, "Brethren and sisters, if you will all of you raise your desires to heaven that the ice may be broken up and we be set at liberty, as sure as the Lord lives, it will be done." And within an instant, there's this crack. She refers to it as bursting thunder. And the captain tells everyone to get to their posts. And there, a passage opens within the ice wide enough for this boat to go through. And but apparently it was a little tight of a squeeze because some of the paddles on the side of the boat were ripped off as they were going through, but the ice closed up after they made their way through. I think what a wonderful story of faith in the infancy of the church by this mother of the prophet.
And who knows, but this may have been the very instant where she became known as Mother Smith.
She, you know, that title was given to her early on. There's references in her record of people referring to her as Mother Smith. I think part of that is indicative of the maternal nature of her in the eyes of the Latter-day Saints, as well as the just her maternal nature towards people within the gospel. There's several accounts of her taking care of the sick and the ill and the afflicted when the saints come to Nauvoo, and ever willing to help people, ever willing to meet their needs, and truly to serve the needy and the ill.
With such a powerful figure as she was, and as spiritual a person as she was the word prophetess ever used in association with Lucy Mack Smith?
Well, you know, there are several titles or several attributes given relating to her within her life, some of them given at the time of her passing. Let me share with you a few of these. At the time of her passing, her nephew George A. Smith gave this very long notice of an obituary and a notice of her death, as well as giving this long expression of her life, her personality, her character traits. And he says this of her: her spirit was like a fountain of light that dispelled error and disseminated truth wherever its influence was felt. She is referred to as a noble mother, blessed among women and queen among the mighty ones. You know, very, very curious titles and great titles. At the time of the death of Joseph and Hiram, shortly thereafter, she received a blessing from Wilford Woodruff. He refers to her as the greatest mother of Israel, greatest mother in Israel. And he also refers to her within this context of his journal. He says the old mother and prophetess. So yes, she is referred to as a prophetess, but there's so many more titles,
right,
that she is given within the context of the saints who knew her.
So we know from the Erie Canal story that she admonished the saints rather strongly. What kind of interaction did she have with church membership generally, should we say?
Well, there's a lot that we can only speculate. We know that she, in terms of the Nauvoo Relief Society, that she did have some involvement there. Of course, at this time in her life, she was in 1842, she lamented that she was not able to gather with the Women's Relief Society as much as she would like to, due to her ill health. In an October 1845 conference of the church, she gets up and speaks for a time, and there is an outpouring of willingness of the saints to help her and support her financially and with whatever physical means that she needs in order to care for herself. It's evident from the outpouring of love that she was greatly admired and greatly loved by the membership of the church. And there's several references to her as Mother Smith. In fact, I think I've seen more references to her as Mother Smith rather than Lucy Mack Smith. It was always Mother Smith.
So it seems like this feeling of the church came more out of her, the actions that she showed toward the church, rather than her being the mother of the prophet, shall we say.
Well, I think that certainly being a part of the Smith family, that there was an honor and reverence toward her. But I think that she played such a key role in the gospel in general. You know, we think of among the people that experienced the gospel from the onset, from the restoration of the gospel in its onset. There is only one woman, really. It was Lucy Mack. And of course, she had her daughters that were there and experienced it all this as well. But Lucy was the only one that could tell readers about Joseph's upbringing, about his formative years. That was rightly her role to tell.
Lucy records having hefted the gold plates and having seen some of the other items that were found with them. Mm-hmm. Do we know if this experience with the items actually increased her fervor for the work?
Well, we really don't get much from her other than the idea of, hefting them. She also was able to, she felt the Urim and Thummim as it was covered with a handkerchief. She also felt the breastplate. There's a time when she's going to bed at night where the bedstead, the head of the bed is resting on the box containing the Book of Mormon manuscript. I would say that those experiences certainly fostered her faith. But a lot of that, her understanding went merely on faith. She didn't see these things. She knew that they were there. I think what integrity that would take to have things within reach and yet not tamper with them, which says a lot about her integrity.
So the phrase faith precedes the miracle, it was nice, I'm sure, and a great and a wonderful thing to her, but she had already had the faith and knew everything that she needed to know before any of this happened, I'm sure. So.
Yeah.
Tell me about Lucy's involvement surrounding the succession in the presidency following the prophet's martyrdom.
That is a very complex situation. There's a few things that are going on with the succession of the presidency. First of all, at the time of Joseph Smith's death, a majority of the Quorum of the Twelve, members of the Quorum of the Twelve were not in Nauvoo at that time. They were in various disparate places. And so there was a time where the members of the Quorum of the Twelve actually came back to Nauvoo. So that took a while to get them actually gathered back there. And there were several people that were vying for the presidency. Sidney Rigdon. There was William Smith believed that the presidency, the leadership of the church, should be retained within the family, Smith family. And Brigham Young as well, insisting that the keys to the kingdom were rolled off to the members of the Quorum of the Twelve, and that the Twelve collectively assumed the leadership of the church. You can imagine what a turbulent time that this was for the membership of the church in, first of all, trying to grapple with the death of their beloved prophet and hire him as their patriarch. Many of the claims that were given by these people for the presidency in some measure were legitimate. And so it wasn't as if these claims were coming out of thin air. Many of them had claims that connected them with Joseph. And even after Brigham Young and the Quorum of the Twelve assumed leadership and the direction of the church, William was still insistent that the leadership should remain within the family. We know that as far as Lucy and her desires for the church and her sentiments with the church, she, in the October 1845 conference of the church, she gets up and tells the saints that she wants to go west with them. And basically her conditions for going west was that her children come with her, and that when she died, that her bones be brought back to Nauvoo to be buried next to her family members.
So we know she desired to go back. Mm-hmm. We know that she wanted her children to go west mm-hmm. with the saints. What actually happened?
Well, there's a number of things that lead up to this that I think should be explained here. First of all, Lucy's health was declining. And there's a several clues that we get regarding this in her history. After the saints were driven from Far West, she ended up getting a cough. There, during this time that they're leaving Far West, there's torrential downpour, and it's just, you know, pounding down on the saints, and the family, several members of the Smith family, get ill. Lucy does as well. As a result of this, she has a cough that afflicts her for the rest of her life. There's a point in 1842 when she's living with Joseph and Emma where she gets very ill, and she reports in her history that after that illness that she can barely walk across the street. And then we get the sense from the Relief Society minutes of her anxiety and distress about not being able to meet with the women more frequently than she does on account of her ill health. And so there's this continued decline of her health. And then by the time in the 1850s, she's bedridden. Early 1850s, she's bedridden. And so the likelihood that she would have been able to withstand one more trip, I question if her health was such that she would have been capable of doing that. Of course, we get the sense when the saints moved west, I think that there's this prevailing erroneous notion that when the saints left in February 1846, that it was one mass exodus and everyone, all the saints came all at once, and which really isn't the case. Granted, there was a significant number of members of the church that were leaving then, but migration west continued in the subsequent decades. And so this issue of Lucy Mack not coming west in 1845 really isn't a particularly significant big deal, because there are saints that are coming west in waves in the 1850s.
So had she had the health, she could have easily come with any of these given
yes,
people coming west.
It's possible. And there, it's evident that there are people that were coming east that would check in on her. We have a number of accounts of there's missionaries that are heading east to catch ships to go on missions to England, and they stop in to see her. There's also missionaries that are coming to the eastern states, and they stop in to see her. The poetess Hannah Tapfield King stops in to see her, which I find one of the more telling stories of interactions with her, with Lucy Mack. I don't know if you want me to.
Please.
Okay.
Great.
There's in 1853, Hannah Tapfield King, an author and poetess, came to Nauvoo to visit Emma and Mother Smith, and she has this. She says that after dinner, she was shown into the room of Lucy Mack Smith, and she refers to her as sitting pillows up in bed, and said that the woman made a great impression on her, and she referred to her as no ordinary woman. Hannah King said, "I feel it would be vain to attempt to describe my feelings with regard to her. I am going to let them run with poetry, for prose would not suffice for me." She is a character that Brother Scott would have loved to have portrayed, and he would have done justice to her. "I do so in my heart, where she has a niche for all time." And she goes on to say that she blessed us with a mother's blessing, this company of travelers that were with her. And Hannah King subsequently writes poems relating to her visit with Lucy Mack for the Desert News. But in these various visits, she talks to people about the reputation and virtue of her sons, and very tearful about that. She has a visit with Enoch Tripp in 1855. Tripp was a teacher in Nauvoo. And when he saw her in bed, and at this time she was very feeble, he approached her bedside and he told her who he was. And she rose up in bed, very exuberant. She places her arms around his neck and kisses him and says, "I can now die in peace since I have beheld your face from the valleys of the mountains." So there's just this warmth and genuine kindness when people came to visit her. She was just so happy that people remembered her and that people took the time to come and see her, that her friends from the valley remembered her.
So she was living with Emma until she died, is that?
Well, there's several. She lived with several of her children in varying times. At this time, she was, in the 1850s, she was living with Emma. She would always, anytime there were visitors, she would, from the West, she'd tell them, you know, give my love to the saints out West. Lucy died. Her death scene is really quite poignant. It's really referred to by her son, Joseph Smith III. He refers to her. He says, "She seemed somewhat fearful of death at a little while before he came, yet appeared resigned afterwards. I sat by her and held her hand in mine till death relieved her. The first death scene I ever witnessed." Joseph Smith III says, you know, she had her senses with her to the last moment. And he said, "But I don't think that she wants to, you know, return from this. You know, this is it for her. She wants to go." Go she did. George A., when he referred to her, passing, he said, "Her name and memory is engraven upon the tablets of the heart of tens of thousands and will be handed down to millions yet unborn that will speak her praise and talk of her virtues and goodness, of her motherly kindness, her watchful care and administration to the sick and afflicted, the kind and affectionate mother, the beloved wife, the partner of her aged and venerable husband, for her deeds of love, her virtue, faith, hope, and confidence in her God, the trials and persecution she bore for the gospel of truth, her unvarying steadfastness to truth through all circumstances, and filled with charity to all. Her God blessed her and nerved her up to bear the persecutions and trials she was called upon to undergo, and gave her strength and grace sufficient for her day, and in copious profusion poured out his Holy Spirit upon her."
Beautiful.
Yeah.
The work that she is best known for, History of Joseph Smith, mm-hmm. is no small feat. When and where in her life did she find time to dictate this, or how did it actually mm-hmm. come about?
Well, there's a number of stories in terms of what generated the interest in creating the history. And I'll briefly go through those varying accounts of why the history was started in the first place. One was that Martha Jane Corey, who lived in Nauvoo, her husband, Howard Corey, at one time served as clerk for Joseph. And so there's this familial connection through her husband's clerking. But there is an account that Martha Jane Corey was in the habit of writing down anything particular of interest to her that came from the pulpit. Many times when there were not scribes there or clerks there taking notes of these sermons. Some of those sermons included Joseph Smith's. She also had a vested interest in the happenings of the Smith family, and she wanted to write down these stories, copy these sermons for children. And so in the winter of 1844, Howard Corey indicates that that this process begins, the writing of this history begins. It's possible that it was completed in July of 1845, but definitely by October of 1845 in the General Conference. When Lucy speaks, she says the history is done.
Wow.
But the method in which it was undertaken is very interesting. Martha Jane Corey's daughter, Martha, later recounts how her mother would go to Mother Smith, and she would write until Mother Smith would grow weary. Mother Smith would tell her what to write, and then Martha would go back and dictate to her what had been written, and then they would discuss it and make the appropriate changes and then move on. At some point in this process, Howard Corey also became involved, it's apparent that when the history was completed, a copy was given to Mother Smith. There was also a copy that was given to the Quorum of the Twelve. A majority of that is written in Howard's hand. He was paid for those services. Martha and Howard's daughter referred to her mother's work involving this history as a labor of love. And so she received no pecuniary compensation for her work. But with it being a labor of love, it was a delight for her to be a part of that. The history was published in 1853 in Liverpool. And there's varying accounts as to how it got over there or how it was part of that process. It seems that the copy that was in Mother Smith's possession at one time made it into the possession of either her son-in-law, Arthur Millikan, Isaac Sheen, who had a familial connection with the, somehow. There's also the idea that Orson Pratt purchased it from her. So there's how it got into Orson Pratt's, there's conflicting information on how it got into Orson Pratt's hands. It was published in 1853 in Liverpool, from the church's press there.
Very good. If you were able to sit down with Lucy Mack Smith for an hour, what do you suppose you'd talk about?
Would an hour be enough time? Could I have an hour and 5 minutes?
Okay.
At least. I don't even know where I would begin. I think that I would have a lot of questions about the early days of the church. There's a point where, and part of the reason that I would ask her that is because there are so few records documenting that. There's a point in later on in a meeting of Joseph Smith with several brethren where he laments that the early church, he says that if they had been better at keeping a record, that there would be no, that every point of doctrine established to that time period, that there would be no question about those doctrines or about questions of the organization of the church. And I would like to know more about those foundational moments of the church. I would probably ask Lucy more about events surrounding the martyrdom, as well as how the dynamics within the Smith family shifted once Joseph and Hiram and Samuel had passed on, and her interactions with Emma.
What, as members of the church, can each of us take away from knowing about Lucy Mack Smith?
Lucy has an unwavering faith. I think for those people who are wavering in their faith, for those people who haven't figured everything out, so to speak, in the gospel, and still have questions, I think Lucy provides an excellent example of continuing to counsel with the Lord. She provides an excellent example of being fearless of consequence, doing the right thing regardless of the consequence. One of the stories of her life that I love is when she is in Far West, and the rumor mill has indicated that the rumor mill claims that Joseph was there at the Gallatin election day battle in August of 38, and that he had killed six or seven men, and he was bringing together a mob of Mormons to kill everyone who wasn't Mormon. And so these Missouri militiamen come into the place where she was staying, and they said, you know, we're going to kill Joseph Smith and all the Mormons. And she says, well, are you going to kill me too? And they said, yeah, we are. And she says, well, do it now. Get it over with. Shoot me down now. Don't murder me by inches. And I think of the nerve of a woman to do that, knowing full well that they had the capacity to do so. But she wasn't going to apologize for who she was. And, of course, the resolution of that whole experience is she introduced them to Joseph, and he won them over in minutes. But that was definitely a moment of strain and tension, not knowing how they would respond. But I think that for women of the church today, for members of the church today, they can take from her that fearlessness in doing the right thing, come what may.
Very good. Thank you. We've been talking with Sherilyn Howcroft today about the life of Lucy Mack Smith. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.